This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Return, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by Keith Brewer. To the Van Wee family, Jeff, Tori, Anna, Audrey, and Ava. Prologue, 2019. The church resembles an alpine chapel, the kind you might find in the mountains outside Salzburg, and inside the cool air is welcoming. Because it's August in the south, the temperature is sweltering, made worse by the suit and tie I'm wearing. In my daily life, I generally don't wear suits. They're uncomfortable. And as a physician, I've learned that my patients respond better to me when I'm dressed more casually, as they tend to be. I'm here to attend a wedding. I've known the bride for more than 5 years now, though I'm not sure that she would consider us friends. Though we'd spoken regularly for more than a year after she left New Bern, our relationship since then has been limited to a couple of texts every now and then, sometimes instigated by her, sometimes by me. We do, however, have an undeniable bond, one that has its roots in events that occurred years ago. Sometimes it's hard for me to remember the man I was when our paths first crossed. But isn't that normal? Life endlessly offers us chances to set new directions, and in the process we grow and change. When we look in the rearview mirror, we catch a glimpse of former selves who sometimes seem unrecognizable. Some things haven't changed. My name, for instance. But I'm 37 now and in the early stages of a new career, one I'd never considered in the first 3 decades of my life. While I'd once loved the piano, I no longer play the instrument. Where I'd grown up with a loving family, it's been a long time since I've seen any of them. There are reasons for that, but I'll get to those parts later. Today, I'm simply glad to be here and to have made it on time. My flight from Baltimore had been delayed, and the line to pick up my rental car was long. Though I'm not the last to arrive, the church is more than half full, and I find a seat in the third row from the back, doing my best to slip in unobserved. The pews in front of me are filled with women, wearing the kind of hats you'd expect to find at the Kentucky Derby, extravagant confections of bows and flowers that goats might enjoy eating. The sight makes me smile, a reminder that in the South, there are always moments when it's possible to slip into a world that seems to exist nowhere else. As I continue to take in my surroundings, the sight of flowers also makes me think about bees. Bees have been part of my life for most of my living memory. They are remarkable and wonderful creatures, endlessly interesting to me. These days, I tend to more than a dozen beehives. It's been much less work than you might imagine, and I've come to believe that the bees take care of me in the same way they take care of everyone. Without them, human life would nearly be impossible, since we rely on bees for a large part of our entire food supply. There's something impossibly wonderful about that concept, that life as we know it can come down to something as simple as a bee making its way from one plant to another. It makes me believe any part-time hobby is important in the grand scheme of things, and yet, I further understand that tending beehives also led me here, to this small-town church, far from the landmarks of home. Of course, my story, like any good story, is also the story of events and circumstances and other people as well, including a pair of old-timers who liked to sit in rocking chairs in front of an old mercantile store in North Carolina. Most important, it's the story of 2 different women, though one was really just a girl at the time. I'm the first to notice that when others tell their stories, they tend to frame them in ways that make them the star. I'll probably fall into the same trap, but I'd like to offer the caveat that most of the events still strike me as accidental. Throughout my telling, please remember that I regard myself as no kind of hero. As for the ending of this story, I suppose this wedding is a coda of sorts. 5 years ago, I would have been hard-pressed to say whether the conclusion of these intertwining tales was a happy, tragic, or bittersweet one. And now? Frankly, I'm even less certain, as I've come here wondering whether the story might in some winding fashion pick up exactly where it left off. To understand what I mean, you'll have to travel back in time with me, to revisit a world that, despite all that has happened in the intervening years, still feels close enough to touch. Chapter 1, 2014. I first noticed the girl walking past my house the day after I'd moved in. Over the next month and a half, I saw her shuffle by a few times a week, head down and shoulders hunched. For a long time, neither of us said a word to each other. I suspected she was in her teens. Something about the way she carried herself suggested she was struggling beneath the twin burdens of low self-esteem and irritation at the world. But at 32, I'd reached the age where it was almost impossible for me to tell. Aside from noting her long brown hair and wide-set eyes, the only thing I knew for sure about her was that she lived in the trailer park up the road and that she liked to walk. Or more likely, she had to walk because she didn't own a car. The April skies were clear, the temperature hovering in the low 70s, with just enough breeze to carry the perfumed aroma of flowers. The dogwoods and azaleas in the yard had roared into bloom almost overnight, framing the gravel road that wound past my grandfather's house, just outside New Bern, North Carolina, a place I'd recently inherited. And I, Trevor Benson, convalescing physician and disabled veteran by profession, was shaking mothballs from a box along the base of the front porch, lamenting that it wasn't how I'd planned to spend my morning. The problem with doing chores around the house was never knowing quite when you might be finished, since there was always something else that needed to be done, or whether fixing up the old place was even worthwhile at all. The house, and I used the term loosely, wasn't much by way of appearance, and the years had taken their toll. My grandfather built it himself after returning from World War II, and though he could build things to last, he didn't have a lot of talent when it came to design. The house was a rectangle, with porches on the front and back, two bedrooms, kitchen, family room, and two bathrooms. The cedar siding had faded to a grayish silver over the years, mimicking my grandfather's hair. The roof had been patched. Air seeped through the windows, and the kitchen floor slanted to the point that if liquid spilled, it became a tiny river that flowed to the door that led to the back porch. I like to think it made cleaning up easier for my grandfather, who'd lived by himself the last 30 years of his life. The property, however, was special. It was a shade over 6 acres, with an aging, slightly tilting barn and a honey shed where my grandfather harvested his honey, and dotted with seemingly every flowering plant known to mankind, including clover patches and wildflowers. From now until the end of summer, the property would resemble a ground-level fireworks display. It was also situated on Bryce's Creek, where dark, brackish water flowed so slowly that it often reflected the sky like a mirror. Sunsets turned the creek into a cacophony of burgundy and red and orange and yellow, while the slowly fading rays pierced the curtain of Spanish moss draped over the tree branches. The honeybees loved the place, which had been my grandfather's intent, since I'm pretty sure he loved bees more than people. There were about 20 beehives on the property. He'd been a part-time apiarist all his life, and it often struck me that the hives were in better condition than either the house or the barn. I'd checked on the hives a few times from a distance since my arrival here, and though it was still early in the season, I could tell the colonies were healthy. The bee population was growing rapidly, as it always did in spring. I could actually hear them buzzing if I listened, and I'd left them to their own devices. Instead, I'd spent most of my time rendering the house livable again. I cleaned out the cupboards, setting aside a few jars of honey to keep, and tossing the remainder. A box of stale crackers, nearly empty jars of peanut butter and jelly, and a bag of dried-out apples. The drawers were crammed with junk, out-of-date coupons, half-used candles, magnets, and pens that didn't work, all of which went into the garbage. The refrigerator was mostly empty and oddly clean, without any of the moldy items or disgusting smells I'd expected. I purged a ton of junk from the house. Most of the furniture was half a century old, and my grandfather had a minor hoarding issue, and then hired various crews to do the more difficult work. I had had a contractor do a cosmetic remodel on one of the bathrooms. A plumber fixed the leak in the kitchen faucet. I had the floors sanded and stained, the interior painted, and last but not least, I had the back door replaced. It was cracked near the jamb and had been boarded over. Then, after bringing in a crew to clean the place from top to bottom, I got my laptop set up with Wi-Fi and picked up some furniture for the living room and bedroom, as well as a new television for the family room. The original television had rabbit ears antennae and was the size of a treasure chest. Goodwill declined the donation of my grandfather's used furniture, despite my argument that it could be all regarded as antiques, so it ended up at the dump. The porches were in relatively good shape, though, and I spent most of my mornings and evenings there, which is how and why I'd started with the mothballs. Spring in the South isn't only about flowers and honeybees and pretty sunsets, especially when you live adjacent to a creek in what seemed like the wilderness. Because it had been warmer than usual recently, snakes had begun to wake from their winter slumber. I'd spotted a big one on the back porch when I'd wandered outside that morning with my coffee. After having the bejesus scared out of me and spilling half the coffee down the front of my shirt, I quickly ducked back inside the house. I had no idea whether the snake was poisonous or what kind it was. I'm not a snake expert. But unlike some people, my grandfather, for instance, I didn't want to kill it either. I just wanted it to stay away from my house and live over there. I knew the snakes did useful things, like killing mice, which I'd heard scurrying in the walls at night. The sound creeped me out, despite spending every summer here when I was a kid. I'm not used to country living. I'd always considered myself more of a condo in the city guy, which is what I had been, right up until the explosion that blew up not only my entire world, but me as well. Which was why I was convalescing in the first place. But more on that later. For now, though, let's get back to the snake. After changing shirts, I vaguely remembered that my grandfather used mothballs to keep snakes away. He was convinced that mothballs had magic powers to repel all kinds of things. Bats, mice, bugs, and snakes. And he would buy the stuff by the case. I'd spotted plenty of them in the barn, and figuring my grandfather must have known something, I seized a box and began to scatter them liberally around the house, first in the back and along the sides, then finally in the front. That was when I again spied the girl trudging down the road that led past the house. She was dressed in jeans and a t-shirt, and when I lifted my gaze, she must have felt my eyes on her because she glanced in my direction. She didn't smile or wave. Instead, she ducked her head, as if hoping to avoid acknowledging my presence. I shrugged and went back to work, if dropping mothballs could actually be considered work. For whatever reason, though, I found myself thinking about the trailer park where she lived. It was at the end of the road, about a mile away. Out of curiosity, I'd walked down there shortly after I'd arrived. It had sprung up since the last time I'd visited, and I suppose I wanted to know who the new neighbors were. My first thought upon seeing it was that it made my grandfather's place look like the Taj Mahal. 6 or 7 ancient and decrepit trailers appeared to have been dropped haphazardly on a dirt lot. In the far corner were the remains of another trailer that had caught fire, leaving only a black, partially melted husk that had never been cleared away. In between the trailers, clotheslines drooped between slanting poles. Scrawny chickens pecked an obstacle course of cars on blocks and rusting appliances, avoiding only a feral pit bull chained to an old discarded bumper. The dog had teeth the size of bacon and barked so ferociously at my presence that spittle flew from its foaming mouth. Not a nice doggy, I remembered thinking. Part of me wondered why anyone would choose to live in a place like this. But then again, I already knew the answer. On my walk back home, I felt pity for the tenants and then chastised myself for being a snob because I knew I'd been luckier than most, at least when it came to money. "Do you live here?" I heard a voice ask. Glancing up, I saw the girl. She doubled back and was standing a few yards away, clearly keeping her distance, but close enough for me to notice a spray of light freckles on cheeks that were so pale as to seem almost translucent. On her arms, I noted a couple of bruises, like she'd bumped into something. She wasn't particularly pretty, and there was something unfinished about her, which made me think again that she was a teenager. Her wary gaze suggested that she was prepared to run if I made the smallest move toward her. "I do now," I said, offering a smile. "But I don't know how long I'll be staying." "The old man died, the one who used to live here. His name was Carl." "I know. He was my grandfather." "Oh." She slipped a hand into her back pocket. "He gave me honey." "That sounds like something he'd do." I wasn't sure if that was true, but it struck me as the right thing to say.
"He used to eat at the trading post," she said. "He was always nice."
Slow Jim's trading post was one of those ramshackle stores so ubiquitous in the South and had been around longer than I'd been alive. My grandfather used to bring me there whenever I visited. It was the size of a 3-car garage with a covered porch out front, and it sold everything from gas to milk and eggs to fishing equipment, live bait, and auto parts. There were old-fashioned gas pumps out front, no credit or debit accepted, and a grill that served hot food. Once I remember finding a bag of plastic toy soldiers wedged between a bag of marshmallows and a box of fishing hooks. There was little rhyme or reason to the offerings on the shelves or displayed on the walls, but I always thought it was one of the coolest stores ever.
"Do you work there?"
She nodded before pointing at the box in my hand.
"Why are you putting mothballs around the house?"
I stared at the box in my hand, realizing that I'd forgotten I was holding it. "There was a snake on my porch this morning. I've heard that mothballs will keep them away." She pursed her lips before taking a step backward.
"Okay, then. I just wanted to know if you were living here now."
"I'm Trevor Benson, by the way." At the sound of my name, she stared at me, working up the courage to ask the obvious.
"What happened to your face?"
I knew she was referring to the thin scar that ran from my hairline to my jaw, which reinforced the impression of her youth. Adults usually wouldn't bring it up. Instead, they'd pretend they hadn't noticed. "Mortar round in Afghanistan, a few years back."
"Oh."
She rubbed her nose with the back of her hand.
"Did it hurt?"
"Yes."
"Oh," she said again. "I guess I'll get going now."
"All right," I said. She started back toward the road before suddenly turning around again.
"It won't work," she called out.
"What won't work?"
"The mothballs. Snakes don't give a lick about mothballs."
"You know that for sure?"
"Everyone knows it."
"Tell that to my grandfather," I thought.
"Then what should I do? If I don't want snakes on my porch?"
She seemed to consider her answer.
"Maybe you should live in a place where there aren't any snakes."
I laughed. She was an odd one for sure, but I realized that it was the first time I'd laughed since I'd moved here, maybe my first laugh in months.
"Nice meeting you."
I watched her go, surprised when she slowly pirouetted.
"I'm Callie," she called out.
"Nice to meet you, Callie."
When she finally vanished from view, blocked by the azaleas, I debated whether to continue putting out mothballs. I had no idea whether she was right or wrong, but in the end, I chose to call it a day. I was in the mood for some lemonade and wanted to sit on the back porch and relax, if only because my psychiatrist recommended that I take time to relax while I still had time. He said it would help me keep the darkness away. My psychiatrist sometimes used flowery language like the darkness to describe PTSD, also known as post-traumatic stress disorder. When I asked him why,
He explained that every patient was different and that part of his job was to find words that accurately reflected the mood and feelings of the patient in a way that would lead the patient along the slow path toward recovery. Since he'd been working with me, he'd referred to my PTSD as turmoil, issues, struggle, the butterfly effect, emotion dysregulation, trigger sensitivity, and, of course, the darkness. It kept our sessions interesting, and I had to admit that darkness was about as accurate a description of the way I'd been feeling as any of them. For a long time after the explosion, my mood was dark, as black as the night sky without stars or a moon, even if I didn't fully realize why. Early on, I was stubbornly in denial about PTSD, but then again, I had always been stubborn. In all candor, my anger, depression, and insomnia made perfect sense to me at the time. Whenever I glanced in the mirror, I was reminded of what had happened at Kandahar Airfield on September 9, 2011, when a rocket aimed at the hospital where I was working impacted near the entrance only seconds after I'd exited the building. There's a bit of irony in my choice of words, since glancing in the mirror isn't the same as it once was. I was blinded in my right eye, which means I have no depth perception. Staring at a reflection of myself feels a little like watching swimming fish on an old computer screensaver. Almost real, but not quite. And even if I were able to get past that, my other wounds are as obvious as a lone flag planted atop Mount Everest. I've already mentioned the scar on my face, but shrapnel left my torso pockmarked like the moon. The pinky and ring finger on my left hand were blown off, particularly unfortunate since I'm a lefty. And I lost my left ear as well. Believe it or not, that was the wound that bothered me the most about my appearance. A human head doesn't look natural without an ear. I looked strangely lopsided, and it wasn't until that moment that I'd ever really appreciated my ear at all. In the rare times I thought about my ears, it was always in the context of hearing things. But try wearing sunglasses with just one ear, and you'll understand why I felt the loss acutely. I haven't yet mentioned the spinal injuries, which meant having to learn how to walk again, or the thrumming headaches that lingered for months, all of which left me a physical wreck. But the good doctors at Walter Reed fixed me up. Well, most of me anyway. As soon as I was upright again, my care shifted to my old alma mater, Johns Hopkins, where the cosmetic surgeries were performed. I now have a prosthetic ear, so well done I can hardly tell it's fake. And my eye appears normal, even if it's completely useless. They couldn't do much about the fingers. They were fertilizer in Afghanistan by then. But a plastic surgeon was able to diminish the size of my facial scar to the thin white line that it is now. It's noticeable. But it's not as though little kids scream at the sight of me. I like to tell myself that it adds character, that beneath the surface of the suave and debonair man before you exists a man of intensity and courage, who has experienced and survived real danger, or something like that. Still, along with my body, my entire life was blown up as well, including my career. I didn't know what to do with myself or my future. I didn't know how to handle the flashbacks, or insomnia, or my hair trigger anger, or any of the other crazy symptoms associated with PTSD. Things went from bad to worse until I hit rock bottom. Think a 4-day bender where I woke up covered in vomit. And I finally realized that I needed help. I found a psychiatrist named Eric Bowen, who was an expert in CBT and DBT, or cognitive and dialectical behavioral therapies. In essence, both CBT and DBT focus on behaviors as a way to help control or manage what you're thinking or feeling. If you're feeling put upon, force yourself to stand up straight. If you're feeling overwhelmed because you're faced with a complex task, try to lessen that sensation with simple tasks of things you can do, like starting with the first easy step, and then after that, doing the next simple thing. It takes a lot of work to modify behavior, and there are a lot of other aspects to CBT and DBT, but slowly but surely, I started to get my act back together. With that came thoughts of the future. Dr. Bowen and I discussed all sorts of career options, but in the end, I realized that I missed the practice of medicine. I contacted Johns Hopkins and applied for another residency, this time in psychiatry. I think Bowen was flattered by that. Long story short, strings were pulled, maybe because I'd been there before, maybe because I was a disabled vet, and exceptions were granted. I was accepted as a psychiatric resident with a start date in July. Not long after I'd received the congratulatory notification from Johns Hopkins, I learned that my grandfather had had a stroke. It occurred in Easley, South Carolina, a town I'd never heard him mention before. I was urged to come to the hospital quickly, as he didn't have much time left. I couldn't fathom why he was there. As far as I knew, he hadn't left New Bern in years. By the time I got there and found him in the hospital, he could barely speak. It was all he could do to choke out a single word at a time. Even those were hard to understand. He said some odd things to me, things that hurt me, even if they made no sense. But I couldn't shake the feeling that he was trying to communicate something important before he finally passed away. As his only remaining family, it was up to me to make the funeral arrangements. I was certain he wanted to be buried in New Bern. I had him transported back to his hometown, set up a small graveside service, which had more attendees than I'd imagined there would be, and spent a lot of time at his house, wandering the property and wrestling with my grief and guilt. Because my parents were so busy with their own lives, I'd spent most of my summers growing up in New Bern, and I missed my grandfather with an ache that felt like a physical vice. He was funny. He was wise and kind, and he always made me feel older and smarter than I really was. When I was 8, he let me take a puff from his corncob pipe. He taught me how to fly fish and let me help whenever he repaired an engine. He taught me everything about bees and beekeeping. And when I was a teenager, he told me that one day I would meet a woman who would change my life forever. When I asked how I would know if I'd met the right one, he winked and told me that if I wasn't sure, then I'd better just keep on looking. Somehow, with all that had happened since Kandahar, I hadn't made time to visit him during the past few years. I know he worried about my condition, but I hadn't wanted to share with him the demons I was battling. Hell, it was hard enough to talk about my life with Dr. Bowen, and even though I knew my grandfather wouldn't judge me, it felt easier to keep my distance. It crushed me that he was taken before I had the chance to really reconnect with him. To top it off, a local attorney contacted me right after the funeral to let me know that I'd inherited my grandfather's property. So I found myself the owner of the very home where I'd spent so many formative summers as a kid. In the weeks following the funeral, I spent a lot of time reflecting on all the words I'd left unspoken to the man who had loved me so unconditionally. My mind also kept returning to the odd things my grandfather had said to me on his deathbed, and I wondered why he'd been in Easley, South Carolina in the first place. Did it have something to do with the bees? Was he visiting an old friend? Dating a woman? The questions continued to gnaw at me. I spoke to Dr. Bowen about it, and he suggested that I try to find the answers. The holidays passed without notice, and with the arrival of the new year, I listed my condo with a realtor, thinking it might take a few months to sell. Lo and behold, I had an offer within days and closed in February. Since I'd soon be moving to Baltimore for residency, it didn't make sense to find a place to rent temporarily. I thought about my grandfather's place in New Bern and figured, why not? I could get out of Pensacola, maybe get the old place ready to sell. If I was lucky, I might even be able to figure out why my grandfather had been in Easley and what on earth he'd been trying to tell me. Which is how and why I found myself scattering mothballs outside his rattletrap old cabin. I didn't really have lemonade on the back porch. That's how my grandfather used to refer to beer. And when I was little, one of the great thrills of my young life was getting him a lemonade from the icebox. Strangely, it always came in a bottle labeled Budweiser. I preferred Yuengling from America's oldest brewery. When I attended the Naval Academy, an upperclassman named Ray Kowalski introduced me to it. He was from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, home of the Yuengling Brewery, and he convinced me there was no finer beer. Interestingly, Ray was also the son of a coal miner, and last I heard, he was serving on the USS Hawaii, a nuclear submarine. I guess he learned from his dad that when you're working, sunlight and fresh air are overrated. I wonder what my mom and dad would have thought about my life these days. After all, I haven't worked in more than 2 years. I'm pretty sure my dad would have been appalled. He was the kind of father who would sit me down for a lecture if I received an A- on an exam, and was disappointed when I chose the Naval Academy over Georgetown, his alma mater, or Yale, where he'd received his law degree. He woke at 5 a.m. every day of the week, read both the Washington Post and the New York Times while having his coffee, then would head to D.C., where he worked as a lobbyist for whatever company or industry group that had hired him. A sharp mind and an aggressive negotiator, he lived to make a deal and could quote large sections of the tax code from memory. He was one of 6 partners who oversaw more than 200 attorneys, and his walls were decorated with photographs of him with 3 different presidents, 6 senators, and too many congressmen to count. My dad didn't simply work. His hobby was work. He spent 70 hours a week at the office and golfed with clients and politicians on the weekends. Once a month, he hosted a cocktail party at our home with still more clients and politicians. In the evenings, he often secluded himself in his office, where there was always a pressing phone call to make, a brief to be written, a plan to be made. The idea of him kicking back on the porch and having a beer in the middle of the afternoon on a workday would have struck him as absurd, something a slacker might do, but never a Benson. There was nothing worse than being a slacker in my father's eyes. Though he wasn't the nurturing type, he wasn't a bad father. To be fair, my mother wasn't exactly a cookie-baking, hands-on PTA member either. A neurosurgeon trained at Johns Hopkins, she was frequently on call and was a good match for my father in her drive and passion for work. My grandfather always said she came out of the wrapper that way, belying her small-town background and the fact that neither of her parents went to college. But I never doubted her or my father's love for me, even if we ate takeout for dinner every night and I attended more cocktail parties as a teenager than family camping trips. In any case, my family was hardly unusual for Alexandria. Everyone at my elite private school had high-powered and prosperous parents, and the culture of excellence and career success filtered down to their children. Stellar grades were the norm, but even that wasn't enough. Kids were also expected to excel at sports or music or both and be popular to boot. I'll admit I got sucked into all of it. By the time I was in high school, I felt the need to be just like them. I dated popular girls, finished 2nd in my class, made all-state soccer in my junior and senior years, and was proficient on the piano. At the Naval Academy, I started on the soccer team all 4 years, double majored in chemistry and mathematics, and did well enough on my MCATs to be accepted to Johns Hopkins for medical school, making my mother proud. Sadly, my parents weren't around to watch me receive my diploma. The accident was something I don't like to think about, nor do I like to tell others what happened. Most people don't know what to say. Conversation falters, and I'm usually left feeling even worse than had I said nothing about them at all. Then again, I sometimes wondered whether I just hadn't told the story to the right person, or if that person was even out there. Someone should be able to empathize, right? What I can say, however, is that I've come to accept that life never turns out quite like one expects. Chapter 2. I know what you might be thinking. How can a guy who considered himself a mental and emotional basket case for the last 2.5 years even think about becoming a psychiatrist? How can I help anyone if I've barely figured out my own life? Good questions. As for the answers, hell, I didn't know. Maybe I'd never be able to help anyone. What I did know was that my options were somewhat limited. Anything surgical was out, what with the partial blindness and missing fingers and all. And I wasn't interested in either family practice or internal medicine. I'd be lying if I said I didn't miss surgery, though. I missed the raw way my hands felt after scrubbing and the sound of the gloves snapping in place. I loved repairing bones and ligaments and tendons and feeling like I always knew exactly what I was doing. There was a kid in Kandahar, about 12 years old, who'd shattered his kneecap falling off a roof a couple of years earlier, and the local physicians had botched the operation so badly that he could barely walk. I had to rebuild the knee from scratch, and 6 months later, when he returned for a checkup, he jogged toward me. I liked the way it made me feel, that I'd fixed him, allowing him to lead a normal life, and wondered whether psychiatry would ever give me that same satisfaction. Because who is ever really fixed when it comes to mental or emotional health? Life takes radical twists and turns, and hopes and dreams shift as people enter different phases of their lives. Yesterday, via Skype, we speak every Monday. Dr. Bowen reminded me that we're all continual works in progress. I was musing about all of this as I stood over my grill later in the evening with the radio playing in the background. The sun was going down, illuminating a kaleidoscope sky as I flipped the New York strip I'd picked up from the village butcher on the far side of town. In the kitchen, I had a salad and baked potato ready to go. But if you're thinking I'm some kind of chef, I'm not. I have a simple palate, and I'm decent with the grill, but that's about it. Since moving to New Bern, I'd been shoving charcoal into my grandfather's old Weber 3 or 4 times a week and setting the coals ablaze. It made me nostalgic for all those summers of my childhood, when my grandfather and I grilled our suppers almost every night. When the steak was ready, I added it to my plate and sat at the table on the back porch. It was dark by then, the house lights glowing from within, and moonlight reflected off the still waters of Bryce's Creek. The steak was perfect, but my baked potato was a bit cold. I would have popped it in the microwave, except for the fact that the kitchen didn't have a microwave. Though I'd made the house livable, I hadn't yet decided on whether to renovate the kitchen, or put on a new roof, or seal the windows, or even fix the slant in the kitchen floor. If I decided to sell the place, I suspected that whoever bought it would tear down the old house so they could put a custom home on the property. You didn't need to be a real estate whiz to figure out that any value to the property was in the land, not the structure. After finishing my dinner, I brought the plate inside and set it in the sink. Opening a beer, I returned to the porch to do some reading. I had a stack of psychiatric books and textbooks I wanted to finish perusing before I moved to Baltimore, on subjects ranging from psychopharmaceuticals to the value and drawbacks associated with hypnosis. The more I'd been reading, the more I felt I had to learn. I had to admit my study skills were rusty. I sometimes felt like I was an old dog and these were new tricks. When I'd said as much to Dr. Bowen, he'd essentially told me to quit whining. Or that's how I took it, anyway. I'd settled into the rocking chair, turned on the lamp, and had just started reading when I thought I heard a voice calling out from around the corner of the house. I turned down the radio, waited a beat, and heard the sound again. Hello? Rising from my seat, I grabbed my beer and moved to the porch railing. Peeking into the darkness, I called back, "Is someone there?" A moment later, a woman in uniform stepped into the light. Specifically, the uniform of a deputy sheriff. The sight caught me off guard. My experience with law enforcement to that point in my life was limited to highway patrolmen, two of whom had pulled me over for speeding in my younger years. Though I'd been apologetic and polite, each of them nonetheless gave me a ticket, and dealing with law enforcement ever since made me nervous, even if I hadn't done anything wrong. I didn't say anything. I was too busy trying to figure out why a deputy sheriff was paying me a visit, while the other part of my brain was processing the fact that the uniformed officer was female. Call me a sexist, but I hadn't interacted with many women in law enforcement, especially down here. "I'm sorry for coming around the side of the house," she finally said. "I knocked, but I guess you didn't hear me." Her demeanor was friendly but professional. "I'm with the sheriff's department." "Can I help you?" Her eyes flickered to the grill, then back to me. "I hope I'm not interrupting your dinner." Not at all, I shook my head. I'm just finished. Oh, good. And again, I apologize for intruding, Mr. Benson, I said. Trevor Benson. I just came by to ask whether you're a legal resident of this property. I nodded, though I was a little surprised by the phrasing. I guess so. It used to be my grandfather's, but he passed away and left it to me.
You mean Carl?
You knew him?
A little. And I'm sorry for your loss. He was a good man.
Yes, he was. I'm sorry, but I didn't catch your name.
Masterson, she said. Natalie Masterson.
She was quiet then, and I had a sense that she was studying me. You said Carl was your grandfather? On my mother's side.
I think he mentioned you. You're a surgeon, right? With the Navy?
I was, but not anymore, I hesitated. I'm sorry, I'm still not exactly sure why you've come by.
Oh, she motioned toward the house. I was finishing up my shift, but I was out this way, and when I saw the lights on, I thought I'd check it out.
Am I not allowed to turn on lights?
No, it's not that, she smiled. Obviously, everything is okay, and I shouldn't have bothered you. It's just that a few months ago, after your grandfather had died, there were reports of lights in the windows. I knew the house was supposed to be empty, so I swung by to check it out. And though I couldn't be certain, I had the impression that someone had been staying here. Not that there was any damage except for the back door, but combined with the lights being seen in the windows, I felt that I should keep an eye on the place. So I've made it a point to swing by every now and then, just to make sure there's no one here that shouldn't be. Vagrants or squatters, teens using the place to party, tweakers working a meth lab, whatever.
Is there a lot of that around here?
No more than other places, I guess, but enough to keep us busy.
Just so you know, I don't do drugs.
She motioned toward the bottle I was holding.
Alcohol is a drug. Even beer?
When she smiled, I guessed she was a few years younger than me, with blonde hair tacked up into a messy bun, and her eyes were so aqua-colored that they could have been bottled and sold as mouthwash. That she was attractive went without saying, and better yet, she wasn't wearing a wedding ring.
No comment, she finally offered.
Would you like to come in and check out the house?
No, that's all right. I'm just glad I don't have to worry anymore. I was fond of Carl. Whenever he was selling honey at the farmer's market, we'd visit for a while.
I remembered sitting with my grandfather at a roadside stand every Saturday during my visits, but I had no recollection of a farmer's market. Then again, New Bern had a lot more of everything now than it had in the past. Restaurants, stores, businesses, even if it still remained a small town at heart. Alexandria, which was just a suburb in the D.C. area and one of many, had 5 or 6 times the population. Even there, I suspect Natalie Masterson would have turned heads.
What can you tell me about the possible squatter? I asked.
I didn't really care about the squatter, but somehow I was reluctant to see her go.
Not much more than I already told you, she said.
Do you think you might come up here? I pleaded, pointing to my ear. So I can hear you better? I was caught up in a mortar attack in Afghanistan.
I could hear her fine, by the way. The inner workings of my ear weren't damaged in the blast, even if the outer part had been torn from my head. It's just that I'm not above playing the sympathy card when I need to. I retreated to my rocker, hoping she hadn't wondered why I seemed to be able to hear her without trouble only moments before. In the porch light, I saw her eyeing my scar before she finally started up the steps. When she reached the other rocker, she angled it toward me, while also sliding it back.
I appreciate this, I said.
She smiled, not overly warm, but enough for me to realize she did indeed have suspicions about my hearing and was still debating whether to stay. It was also a wide enough smile to notice her white and perfectly straight teeth.
As I was saying,
are you comfortable? I asked. Can I offer you something to drink?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm on duty, Mr. Benson.
Call me Trevor, and please, start at the beginning.
She sighed, and I could have sworn I saw the trace of an eye roll.
There was a series of electrical storms last November after Carl passed away. A lot of lightning, and at the trailer park down the road, one of the trailers caught fire. The fire department responded, so did I.
and not long after the fire was out, one of the guys mentioned that he likes to go hunting on the far side of the creek. It was just small talk, you know? I nodded, remembering the burned-out husk I'd noticed my first week here. Anyway, I happened to bump into him a couple of weeks later, and he mentioned that he'd noticed lights in your grandfather's house, not just once, but two or three times, like a candle being carried past the windows. He was kind of far away, and I wondered if it had been his imagination, but since it kept happening and he knew that Carl had died, he thought he should mention it. When would this have happened? Last December, maybe mid-month. There was a week or two there when it was really cold, so it wouldn't have surprised me if someone broke in just to stay warm. The next time I was in the area, I stopped by and saw that the back door was broken and the knob had almost fallen off. I went inside and did a quick search, but the place was empty. Aside from the broken door, I didn't find evidence that anyone had been inside. There was no trash, and the beds were made. As far as I could tell, nothing appeared to be missing. But she paused, frowning at the recollection. I took a sip of beer, waiting for her to go on. There were a pair of used candles on the counter with blackened wicks and a half-empty box of candles as well. I also noticed that some of the dust had been wiped away at the kitchen table, like someone had eaten there. It also seemed like someone had been using one of the recliners in the family room, because there was cleared space on the neighboring side table, and it was the only piece of furniture in the living room that wasn't dusty. It wasn't anything I could prove, but just in case, I found some extra boards in the barn and sealed the back door. "Thanks for that," I said. Though she nodded, I could tell something about those memories was still bothering her. She went on. "Did you happen to notice whether anything was missing when you moved in?" I thought about it before shaking my head. Not that I could tell. Except for the funeral in October, I hadn't been down here in a few years, and that week is a bit hazy in my memory. "Was the back door intact then?" "I went in through the front, but I'm sure I checked all the locks when I left. I think I would have noticed if the back door was damaged. I know I spent time on the back porch." "When did you move in?"
"End of February."
She digested that, her eyes flashing to the back door.
"You believe someone did break in, don't you?" I finally asked.
"I don't know," she admitted. "Usually when something like that occurs, things are broken and there's trash strewn about. Bottles, food wrappers, detritus. And vagrants don't usually make the bed before they leave." She thrummed her fingers on the rocker. "Are you sure nothing was missing? Guns? Electronics? Did your grandfather keep cash around?"
"My grandfather didn't have much in the way of electronics or cash, as far as I know. And his gun was in the closet when I moved in. It's still there, by the way. It's a small shotgun to keep the varmints away."
"That makes it even stranger, because usually guns are the first thing stolen."
"What do you make of it?"
"I don't know," she said. "Either no one was there, or you were visited by the tidiest and most honest vagrant in history."
"Should I be worried?"
"Have you seen or heard anyone creeping around the property since you've moved in?"
"No, and I'm frequently awake during the night."
"Insomnia?"
"Some, but it's getting better."
"Good," she said, adding nothing more. She smoothed the pants of her uniform. "But I've taken enough of your time. That's all I can really tell you."
"I appreciate you swinging by and telling me about all this, and for fixing the door."
"It wasn't much of a fix."
"It did the job," I said. "It was still boarded up when I got here. How much longer is your shift?"
She glanced at her watch. "Actually, believe it or not, it's over now."
"Then are you sure I can't get you a drink?"
"I don't think that would be a good idea. I still have to drive home."
"Fair enough," I said. "But before you go, and since you're off and I'm new in town, tell me what I need to know about New Bern these days. I haven't been here in a while."
She paused, arching an eyebrow. "Why would I do that?"
"Aren't you supposed to protect and serve? Think of this as the serve part, like fixing my door."
I tried out my most winning smile. "I don't think that being a welcoming committee is part of my job description," she deadpanned.
"Maybe not," I thought, "but you haven't left yet."
"All right," I said. Tell me what made you want to become a sheriff. With my question, she looked at me, maybe truly for the first time, and again I found myself transfixed by the color of her eyes. They were like the waters of the Caribbean in an upscale travel magazine. I'm not the sheriff. That's an elected position. I'm a deputy.
Are you avoiding my question?
I'm wondering why you want to know.
I'm a curious person, and since you helped me out, I feel like I should know at least a little about the person who did the helping.
Why do I get the impression you have an ulterior motive?
Because you're not only pretty, you're obviously smart as well, I thought.
I shrugged, feigning innocence. She studied me before finally responding. Why don't you tell me about yourself first?
Fair enough. Ask away.
I'm guessing that the mortar round is the reason you're no longer in the Navy or a doctor.
Yes, I said. I was hit by a mortar just as I was leaving the hospital where I worked. Lucky shot. Or for me, unlucky. Fairly serious injuries. In the end, the Navy put me on disability and let me go.
Tough break.
It was, I admitted.
And you're in New Bern because...
It's only a temporary stay, I said. I'm moving to Baltimore this summer. I'm starting a new residency in psychiatry.
Really?
She asked. Is there something wrong with psychiatry?
Not at all. It's just not what I expected you to say.
I can be a good listener.
It's not that, she said. I'm sure you are. But why psychiatry?
I want to work with veterans with PTSD, I said. I think there's a need for it these days, especially with soldiers and Marines doing 4 or 5 rotations. As I mentioned, it can stay with a person after they're back. She seemed to be attempting to read me.
Is that what happened with you?
Yes. She hesitated, and I had the sense she continued to really see me.
Was it bad?
No question, I said. Terrible. And it still is, every now and then. But that's probably a story for another time.
Fair enough, she offered. But now that I know, I'll admit that I was wrong. It sounds like it's exactly what you should do. How long is a psychiatric residency?
5 years.
I've heard residencies are hard.
It's no worse than being dragged by a car down the highway. For the first time, she laughed. I'm sure you'll do fine. But I do hope you find some time to enjoy our town while you're here. It's a beautiful place to live, and there are a lot of good people here.
Did you grow up in New Bern?
No, she answered. I grew up in a small town.
That's funny.
But true, she said. Can I ask what you intend to do with the place when you leave?
Why, are you interested in buying?
No, she said, and I doubt I could afford it. She brushed a strand of hair from her eyes. Where are you from, by the way? Give me a quick sketch of who you are. Pleased that she was interested, I gave her a brief history. My youth in Alexandria, my parents, my regular summertime visits to New Bern when I was younger, high school, college, medical school, and residency, my time with the Navy, all with a touch of the modest hyperbole men use when trying to impress an attractive woman. As she listened, her eyebrows twitched more than once, but I couldn't tell whether she was fascinated or amused.
So you're a city boy?
I beg to differ, I protested. I'm from the suburbs. Her lips turned up slightly at the corners, but I couldn't read the intent behind it.
What I don't understand is why you went to the Naval Academy, if you were such a brilliant student, I mean, and were accepted at Yale and Georgetown.
Brilliant? Did I actually use that word earlier?
I wanted to prove to myself that I could make it without my parents' help. Financially, I mean.
But didn't you say they were rich?
Oh, yeah. I vaguely remember saying that, too.
Well-to-do, I should have said.
So it was a pride thing.
And service to our country.
She nodded slightly, her eyes never leaving mine.
Good.
Almost as an afterthought, she added, there are a lot of active duty military in the area, as you probably know. Cherry Point, Camp Lejeune. Many of them have spent time in Afghanistan and Iraq.
I nodded. When I was posted overseas, I worked with doctors and nurses from every region of the country in all sorts of specialties, and I learned a ton from them, while it lasted anyway. And we did a lot of good, too. Most of our work was with locals. Many of them had never been seen by a doctor before the hospital opened. She seemed to consider my words. A chorus of crickets sounded in the silence before I heard her voice again. "I don't know that I could have done what you did." I tilted my head. "I'm not sure what you mean." "Experiencing the horrors of war every single day and knowing there are some people who are beyond your power to help, I don't think I would be able to handle something like that. Not in the long run, anyway." As she spoke, I had the impression she was sharing something personal, though I'd heard the same thing from others before in regard to both the military and medicine in general. "I'm sure you've seen some terrible things as a deputy."
"I have."
"And yet you still do it."
"Yes," she said. "And sometimes I wonder how long I'll be able to continue. There are times when I fantasize about opening a flower shop or something like that."
"Why don't you?"
"Who knows? Maybe one day I will."
Again, she grew quiet. Sensing her distraction, I broke her reverie with a lighthearted prompt. "Since you won't give me a rundown of what's new in town, at least tell me what your favorite place is."
"Oh, I don't go out that much," she demurred.
"Except for the farmer's market downtown. It's open Saturday mornings. But if you're trying to find some excellent honey, you'll probably be out of luck." "I'm sure my grandfather still has plenty."
"You don't know for sure?"
"There are a few jars in the cupboard, but I haven't checked the honey shed yet. I've been too busy fixing up the place. I mean, a palace like this doesn't just happen by accident." This time she smiled, if a tad reluctantly. She nodded toward the dock.
"Have you gone out in the boat yet?"
I haven't yet mentioned the boat, but suffice it to say that it was a lot like the house, only in worse condition. Even calling it a boat was somewhat generous, because it looked less like a boat than an outhouse and two vinyl recliners all bolted to a floating platform. My grandfather built it using discarded oil drums and lumber of varying sizes, along with whatever else he could find. And when he wasn't checking on the bees, he was always tinkering with it. "Not yet. I'm not sure the engine even works."
"I know it was working last summer, because Carl told me.
It's kind of a hard boat to miss, and your grandfather loved to take it out. People take photos of it whenever they see it." "It is a bit eccentric, isn't it?"
"It suited him, though."
"Yes," I admitted. "It did." She sighed and stood.
"I really should be going. I've got some things to do at home. It was a pleasure meeting you, Mr. Benson."
"Mr. Benson? I had hoped we'd moved beyond that, but I guess not." She started down the steps, reaching the bottom in the same instant my brain finally kicked back into gear. "You don't have to walk around the back and side of the house. You can go through to the front door if it's easier."
"Thank you, but I'll just retrace my steps. Have a good evening."
"You too. And it was nice meeting you, Natalie." She raised an eyebrow before turning away. With a couple of quick steps, she vanished from sight. After a few beats, I heard a door slam in the driveway and her vehicle start up, all of which left me contemplating the intriguing Natalie Masterson. That she was beautiful, anyone would notice. But what I found interesting about her was how little she'd told me about herself. It's been said that women are the mysterious sex, and even now, my first inclination is to laugh when a guy I'm talking to says he understands what makes women tick. I was flummoxed by the one-sided nature of the conversation. I'd told her a lot about myself, but had learned almost nothing about her. I did, however, have a hunch that I would see her again, if only because I knew just where I might find her. Chapter 3. In the morning, I went for a run, something I hadn't been consistent about since arriving in town. I would tell myself that I had more important things to do, like spreading mothballs to keep snakes away. But the simple truth is that I don't always enjoy exercising. I know all the benefits. I'm a doctor, remember?
but unless I was chasing or dribbling a soccer ball, running always seemed kind of silly to me. But I did it, 6 miles at a steady pace. When I finished, I did 100 push-ups and sit-ups. After a quick shower and a bite to eat, I was ready to face the day. Of course, since I technically had no real responsibilities, I decided on another quick survey of the house to check if anything was missing, which was something of an impossible task, since I hadn't known what had been in the house when he'd left town, and I'd already cleaned out the place. In the closet, I spotted the shotgun again and found the shells. There was no other ammunition, which led me to believe there'd been no other weapons. In a box under the bed in the guest room, however, I discovered a wad of cash wrapped in a rubber band beneath a thick envelope that held various documents and photographs of my grandmother's, social security card, medical records concerning her epilepsy, things like that. It wasn't a lot of money, enough for a couple of fancy dinners, maybe, but definitely enough to entice someone who might want money for drugs or booze. Had someone been there, it would have been stolen, right? Which meant that the place had likely remained unoccupied. And yet, the door had been broken. I shook my head. Either way, even if someone had been there, they were long gone by now, so I put it out of my mind and decided to hit the books on the back porch for a while. Unfortunately, they weren't exactly page turners, and after a couple of hours, I'd had enough. On the plus side, no snakes appeared, which made me wonder whether Callie had known what she was talking about. I'll admit that my mind wandered at times toward the lovely Natalie Masterson. She was an enigma, and I kept picturing the amused flicker I saw in her eyes as I related my slightly embellished history. But thinking about my conversation with Natalie also reminded me of the bees and the boat, which turned my thoughts to my grandfather, and it brought to mind my last visit here. At the time, I'd been a resident, and while others were heading off to the Caribbean or Cancun for well-deserved respites, I made the drive from Baltimore to New Bern, seeking the comfort and abiding love that I had always sought from him as a child. He was his own cup of tea. The boat was a good example of his quirkiness, but he had limitless room in his heart for unsheltered souls. He was the kind of guy who'd feed whatever strays happened to drift onto his property. He'd set out a line of bowls near the barn, and various dogs from God knows where would begin showing up. He named the ones that stuck around after cars. As a kid, I played fetch with dogs named Cadillac, Edsel, or Ford, Chevy, and Pinto. Oddly, he also named one Winnebago. It was a tiny thing, some sort of terrier, and when I asked him why, he winked and declared, "Look at the size of him." In his working life, he'd been employed at the mill, turning logs into usable lumber. Like me, he finished his life with fewer fingers than when he started. Unlike me, it didn't cause his career to come crashing to an end. He used to tell me that unless a man had lost a finger on the job, it wasn't a real job, which makes the idea that he raised my mother, a sophisticated, ambitious, cerebral woman, if there ever was one, rather astounding. When I was younger, I used to suspect my mother had been adopted, but as I matured, I eventually came to recognize that they shared an innate optimism and decency that informed everything they did. My grandfather hadn't had an easy time after my grandmother had died. I don't remember her at all, as I was still toddling around in diapers the only time we met. But I can recall my mom emphasizing that it was important to visit him, so that he wasn't always alone. For my grandfather, there was only one woman he'd loved once and for all, right up until an epileptic seizure took her life. There's still a photograph of her on the wall of the bedroom, and after moving in, I couldn't imagine taking it down, even though I never knew her. That she was my grandfather's North Star was more than enough reason to keep it hanging exactly where it was. But it was odd being at the house. It felt empty without my grandfather, and wandering into the barn deepened the feeling of loss. It had the same cluttered atmosphere as the house I'd inherited. Inside were not only mothballs and a wide assortment of tools, but an old tractor, numerous engine parts, bags of sand, pickaxes, shovels, a rusting bicycle, an army helmet,
a cot and blanket that looked as though someone had actually slept there, and countless remnants of a lifetime of collecting things. I sometimes wondered whether my grandfather had ever thrown anything away, but close inspection revealed no trash, ancient magazines, newspapers, or debris that belonged in a garbage can. There were only items that he felt he might one day need for whatever project he was working on. On the night I received the call from the hospital, I wasn't doing much of anything. There was no reason I couldn't have visited him that week, or a month, or even a year earlier. Or even, I knew, when I'd been at my very worst. He'd never been a man to judge, and even less likely when it came to the effects of war on a person. At 20, he'd been shipped to North Africa. In the years that followed, he'd fought in Italy, France, and then Germany. He'd been wounded at the Battle of the Bulge, only to return to his unit not long after the army crossed the Rhine. I knew nothing about any of it from him, since he never spoke about the war. My mom mentioned it, though, and a few days after my arrival here, I discovered the records, along with his Purple Heart and various service medals. According to my mom, he got interested in bees not long after he built the house. Back then, there'd been a farm up the road, and my grandfather had worked there before getting a job at the mill. The farmer had beehives but didn't like tending to them. My grandfather was put on the task. Since he knew nothing about beekeeping, he checked out a book from the library and eventually learned the rest on his own. To him, they represented an almost perfect species, and he'd hold